It's hard to believe that we have been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
So many great conversations over the years about so many great movies. All that said, producing this show week after week requires a ton of work behind the scenes.
Becoming a Next Reel member gives you access to all sorts of additional and exclusive content. Plus, you're helping us keep the lights on. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership, where you can learn more about becoming a member, which costs a measly $5 a month, practically the same as one fancy coffee drink. And you get so much more.
Every month, we record a bonus episode exclusively for members. Those episodes cover movies from whatever series we're covering at the moment, or add to previous series.
Some movies we've covered that only members get to hear us discuss include The Blues Brothers,
The Russia House,
Naked Lunch,
Independence Day,
The Hot Rock,
and Relic, the better one. Plus, members get to vote on what we're going to discuss for those episodes.
We also record additional pre- and post-show content in regular episodes that only members get to hear.
Like conversations about similarly themed movies.
And answering listener questions from our live member chat.
Speaking of our live member chat, we record almost all of our episodes in Discord, where members can chat right along with us live.
Members get access to other members-only channels in our Discord community as well. On top of all that, members get all episodes a full week earlier than everyone else in a private Next Reel feed just for them that includes all the shows in the Next Reel family. The Next Reel, The Film Board,
Movies We Like, Sitting in the Dark, and more new projects on the way.
To top it all off, members don't have to listen to ads. We've already eliminated those annoying, dynamically inserted ads that, let's face it, we all hate it.
We are listening to you.
We love podcasting for a living, and those ads help to pay the bills. Now, we're counting on you, dear listener.
We promise. We aren't going back to those terrible, dynamically inserted ads that don't relate to us at all. All we ask is that you consider supporting the Next Reel family of podcasts with a membership.
Again, it's $5 per month or $55 per year. Just head to thenextreel.com/membership.
thenextreel.com/membership. Get your access to early, ad-free episodes with bonus content, member bonus episodes, and access to member channels and live streams in Discord by signing up today. I'm Pete Wright.
And I'm Andy Nelson.
Welcome to The Next Reel. When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Mulholland Drive is over. No, I banda!
I can't believe it. I'm just so excited to be here. I'm in this dream place.
This one comes highly recommended.
Dream place? What are you doing?
Get out of the car.
Yeah. The girl is still missing.
Mulholland Drive, Andy. It's time to talk about a little Lynch.
We made it.
We made it? This is peak Next Reel that we finally arrived. This is a mountain we've been climbing.
Now we can finally end this show. We finally hit Mulholland Drive.
We did it. We've arrived.
Yeah, we haven't talked about a lot of Lynch on the show. I think is the only other film we've discussed, Wild at Heart, which was one of our member bonus episodes?
I think so.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, only 10 films to his name, plus, of course, the Twin Peaks show.
Yeah.
I enjoy David Lynch quite a bit. I enjoy the crazy worlds that he ends up creating, the crazy stories that he weaves. And this certainly fits right into all of that.
Yeah.
Is this one that you saw in theaters when it came out?
Yeah.
You did. Okay. Me too.
And I never saw it again after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is the first time since theater.
Oh. Uh-huh. I mean, I haven't seen it a lot since theater. I think I saw it maybe twice outside of the theater. Not a lot, but I don't know. Very fascinating one. Do you remember your initial reaction to it when you saw it?
Yeah. No, I hated it. I hated it so much.
Okay. Okay.
To say that I have, and I'll tell you, because I know that you think going into this conversation, I'm going to be a real bear on this movie, that I just hated the movie again. And I will tell you, that's not true. I've softened quite a bit on the movie. And I think just, you know, with age and having seen so many more movies since then, and maybe it's because I sat down with my wife and another couple over the weekend and we watched Poor Things together, and I watched them struggle with that movie as it just sort of let it wash over me. And I just think I'm in a different place as a movie watcher. And so, yeah, I've softened on it a lot. I haven't softened on it completely. And so that's, I think, worthy of discussion. But I'm not, this is not a one-star film. I'll tell you that right now.
Just out of curiosity, since Lynch has made such a small number of films, what have you seen of his? Let's just walk through his filmography. I'm curious, like, where you stand with Lynch. So have you seen Eraserhead?
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen The Elephant Man?
Yeah.
Have you seen Dune?
Andy,
I know,
please.
We've talked about that quite a bit. Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
A Wild at Heart, we've discussed on the show. Twin Peaks, the TV show?
Oh, yeah.
And Fire Walk With Me, the movie?
Yeah.
Lost Highway?
I have not seen Lost Highway.
Okay. The Straight Story.
I've not seen The Straight Story.
Okay. And then Mulholland Drive is this. And then Inland Empire is his 2006 film, the last film he's made.
Yep.
And of course, he just did the new Twin Peaks, The Return on Showtime. Did you watch any of that?
I did not watch any of that.
Okay. So I haven't seen Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, but I've seen the rest of the films. And I haven't seen that because I have never finished the Twin Peaks TV show. And I only recently, for the first time, started watching the show because it's on Netflix. And then I kind of lost track of it. I forgot I was watching it. And so I have now said, you know what, I'm just going to commit to it. And I'm just going to finish that damn show, Watch it. And then I can finally watch Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me. And call it good. I will have closed the loop on his. Well, except Twin Peaks The Return, because it's on Showtime, I'm going to have to figure out a way to watch that one. But I do want to watch that one. So. So in general, do you like Lynch? Like when you think of Lynch and you think of this list of films, do you go, no, not another one?
So I think it's important to separate like that, the emotional reality of my experience with David Lynch films and the sort of appreciation of David Lynch films. Like, I think it is fascinating that David Lynch has been able to make the movies that David Lynch has made, that there is commercial and critical appeal at some level for these films, that Twin Peaks was a legit hit. Like, Twin Peaks was a cultural thing that people gathered around the TV to watch, at least in my circle, in my parents' circle, for sure. It was a thing people were talking about. And so they're fascinating. I think Twin Peaks, the series, is, I have the highest, like, sort of personal relationship with. I like that the most. I liked the characters and the world and I liked being able to invest longer in the universe of Twin Peaks. And I sometimes feel like I'm ramrodded a little bit with David Lynch's world building in his films. Like I almost feel like he's a creator out of time, that maybe had he come into his own in the streaming universe, he might have created some incredible 8 and 12 part series. That, like, Mulholland Drive, we'll talk about it. Mulholland Drive, to me, is a movie that was robbed of its series and would have been amazing as a long-form piece and was robbed of that. And so I think that's kind of where I struggle. Do I like the earlier films of, Elephant Man, Blue Velvet? And like, yeah, I do. I actually sit down and I appreciate them. Do I love them personally as movies, like five-star movies in the heart that I can't wait to go back to, that I keep watching on the background on loop while I'm doing other things? No, I don't have that kind of relationship with David Lynch, but I appreciate what he's doing for sure.
Yeah, I find the more I watch David Lynch, the more I enjoy him. Like, I'm always excited by what he's doing. I think the Elephant Man was the first film I saw of his on TV at some point. And, you know, I suppose you could say it's not as much a Lynch film as something like Eraserhead, which was before it. It's definitely a little more kind of a straightforward story. But I think where you come into the Lynchianness of it is everything about Joseph Merrick
the titular Elephant Man and like the realities of his world. I think that's where Lynch was able to kind of make for a really interesting journey for that story and that character. And then Blue Velvet was the next one I saw. And I watched that a lot, like through high school and college. Just, it was such a wild ride of a film. Just crazy, crazy, crazy. I really enjoyed it. And so I've just kind of always enjoyed watching him. And even when it's something like Lost Highway, and I'll never forget watching that in the theater, and my friend, when it ended, stood up and just shouted, "I get it!" Like, you know, it's one of those things where his films are so, this level of dreams, like in the films, like as kind of the subconscious exploration of his own mind that he's putting into it. And so I just generally am quite excited by what he's doing. And even when I don't fully understand what's going on, I get just really excited by the projects. And Mulholland Drive, I saw in the theater, and I just remember it was one of those films that after my wife and I left the theater, we just were talking about it for hours, like all the different puzzle pieces that were in it. It's just such an interesting film, and definitely one that, you know, I'm excited in the context here that we finally get to talk about it here.
There's an interesting thing going on with David Lynch, and in particular this movie. I think David Lynch, and I talk about this all the time, like it's one of my favorite things, like how much does the director trust me to keep up? And I think David Lynch is one of those interesting directors where I often, like, he presents the movie as if he trusts me to keep up, right? Like, he gives an awful lot of agency to the audience to just, you know, go along for the ride. And whatever comes out of your experience with the movie is the experience of the movie, right? Famously does not talk about what his movies mean. Famously does not talk about, you know, plot and things like that after a movie has come out. He just leaves that to you, the audience. But it can come off as a bit sort of pathological, right? It's not that he trusts me. It's that he doesn't care about me at all. Right. As an audience member, like he doesn't see this as a dance at all between filmmaker and audience member. And sometimes it can feel malicious. Some of the clues that he can drop in here are malicious. And that is a thing that, you know, I think just can get frustrating for a lot of people, I think, watching who don't like David Lynch movies I think that's where it comes from. That hit me as I was watching this movie.
So, okay. So, well, with that, then let's talk a little bit about what we think is going on here.
Yeah, I'm all ears.
That might be a good place to start because there is a lot happening in this film. You know, we start this film with a woman played by Laura Herring who is in a limo and about to be killed, it seems. But then suddenly, out on Mulholland Drive, we see the street sign. That's the name of the film. And suddenly, a bunch of joyriders who are driving crazy accidentally crash into the limo and kill everybody in it except for her, who manages to escape. She has amnesia. She makes it down onto Sunset Boulevard, finds her way into an apartment and ends up in this place where young Betty, who is Naomi Watts, she is an aspiring actress, comes to town and she's going to stay at her aunt's place, who's out of town. It is, of course, the same place where our amnesiac is at. And they become friends. And we kind of are in this journey between these two characters as this mystery woman calls herself Rita, based on a poster hanging in the room here. And she's trying to figure out who she is. Betty wants to become an actress, and so we're kind of following her journey. Then we shift into another story as they kind of disappear into a box, and this is toward the end of the film, but like suddenly Betty is now Diane and Rita is now Camille. It's a whole other story, but it seems like somehow connected to our previous story, because as they're doing detective work to figure out who Rita is, they end up in Diane's apartment and find her dead in bed. And so it's this whole story kind of taking place in Hollywood. It's this journey of this mystery, like, who is this woman? Why is someone trying to kill her? What is going on with this other side of the story that's taking place kind of inside this blue box?
Okay.
What did you take from it? You're You seem less excited or I don't know, excited, but it seems a little more of a muddling film for you.
Well, it's not so much that. And I think that's what I mean. Like the movie is I think much better on rewatch. And I think when I saw it the first time, I didn't stop and investigate. I just was like, what happened to this movie? This movie's dumb, right? Let's kind of like gut reaction. And I just never thought about it again. Watching it this time, it just is much more clear to me that really the movie is strangely... Okay, let me take a step back. The movie opening credits are really important, right? The opening credits of the Jitterbug contest are really important. And then the Jitterbug happens, and then like we have the close-up or the fall into the pillow, and it feels like there's a dream that starts there. And that's the challenge of the movie, that the entire movie is a dream until Camille opens the blue box with the dream key, the blue dream triangle key, and which is representative of the real dream blue key that we see sitting on the table after. And what we've really seen is Diane dreaming of herself as Betty the ingenue before her life was poisoned by, you know, all these horrible things that had happened. And essentially, in the dream, if you use the Jungian kind of approach to looking at this movie, everybody in the movie, Rita, Adam, everybody in the movie is a representation of Diane's identity. And they're all interacting with each other, but it's all effectively her. This is a Jungian dream interpretation movie. And that's what I got out of it this time. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly fair. Again, as you pointed out, Lynch famously does not explain his films. And so this film, even for the actors who were in it, has been left open to interpretation, and they had to kind of come up with their own interpretation as to what's actually happening here. And I think there's a large part of it that is exactly the way that I've interpreted it is it, you know, starts in a similar way that you have, where it's a story of Diane. Now, I think the last part of the film that we see where Diane, she has this girlfriend, Camilla, who is an actress and is falling for this director that she's with. And Diane is starting to feel jealousy and upset and hurt by all of this, to the point where there's never quite a breakup. It doesn't seem like they actually break up, but it does feel to Diane like Camilla leaves her and goes to the director, and now they're going to get married, and is heartbroken and decides to hire this person who is going to kill her. She is so distraught by everything that is going on with this, the decisions she made, that she decides to kill herself. And in those final moments, the way that I've interpreted it is like in those final moments, we get all of those memories flashing through her head of her past life as kind of doing all these dance contests and winning in these dance competitions, meeting those old people on her journey to LA that become subconscious, that we see as little versions of themselves running around.
And demons. They become sort of demons.
Well, and they're in this, there's this demon thing that's in the alley for sure. All of these things are kind of different parts of her subconscious, but I think that she really did hire this person to kill her lover, and that all of this story that we had seen beforehand is kind of this fictional version in her head of what she was imagining had happened. You know, it starts with Camilla at this point, aka Rita, getting an attempt on her life, and all of this stuff of her trying to find a way to make them come back together as this happy couple.
So, Kevin, let me ask you something. I just got to ask. So, in your interpretation of this, the dream that she's having is essentially a retcon of what really happened?
It's a kind of a retcon as she's dying, right? Like, you know, as she's dying or right before she's dying, like all of this stuff that just seems very hallucinatory. And I don't know if I've pinpointed, like, is all of it in the moment before death? I don't know, because it's like we've got all that jitterbug dancing. We've got all of the happy flashes of her and the old people that seem to be like she won the contest or on her journey here. And then the falling into the pillow, which is like her dying, right? You can see like that's her. She's falling down. She's going to shoot herself.
Yeah, she falls into those sheets, right?
Right. And then suddenly it's like now we're going into this whole other world. And so I feel like a lot of it may be imagining what she wants everything to be, or kind of like this alternate reality where they're happy together. But there still is this mystery that she can't get past because her psyche knows all of the stuff that, you know, is in the real world. And that's why the happy version of them get drawn into this mystery that leads them going to that apartment and seeing essentially Diane's dead body in bed. She's kind of acknowledging to herself that she's gone through and done all of this. And so that's kind of how I interpret it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things, though, that sequence of seeing her own dead body is one of the things that I think is I think maybe supports the idea that none of it happened. And yet, when she's up in real life, right, when she's awake in the last act of the movie, she's standing in her kitchen, and there is this incredible moment where she sees Camilla, and Camilla's all done up, like with makeup on, does not look like Diane does at the time, strung out. I think Naomi Watts plays this perfectly. Like she's smiling and then she breaks. Like it's this really subtle, not subtle break of awareness that she has lost everything that she had just dreamed about, which to your point may have been the relationship that she was never able to fulfill as the true part of her story was unraveling in her dream, and the mistakes that she had made and the choices that weren't made and the parts that she never got. And that moment to me is the moment she realizes her life is gone and she makes the decision to end it.
Well, and what's interesting there is we cut from her face looking at her and smiling, and Naomi Watts, and then we cut over to Laura or Camilla's character, and we see her, and then we see Naomi Watts, and then when she looks back, it's Naomi Watts over there now.
Yes.
Like it's her own self.
Yeah.
And so it is kind of like, was she there? Is she imagining it? There is this other element. Like, because even in the real world, strange things happen. Like, we had met that neighbor who they had done that apartment swap, and we know that she wanted to get some stuff from the apartment that she had left behind. And she comes down to get her stuff, and she gets that box of dishes, and she's like, oh, I think that ashtray is mine. And Diane's like, well, go ahead and take it. So she takes it. It looks like a little piano. Like, it's a little piano ashtray. She takes that with her later, which can only assume at that point be a fantasy. After that moment where Camilla's kind of disappeared, we have Diane kind of fall over the sofa and Camilla is laying there naked, and they have a moment of this great sex and all of that sort of stuff. And that ashtray is back on the table, which makes me think that we've kind of gone back into kind of her delusions, her fantasies of imagining that life again, which to your point, may be the thing that now that she's lost it, all she can do is fantasize about it and decides to kill herself.
Yeah. Okay. That makes perfect sense to me. Now, let me just ask you this. Who's Mr. Roque? Do we need to care about Mr. Roque? Let's get into the seedy underbelly of Hollywood, right? Because once we figure out the fact that this movie is really Pixar's Inside Out, made by David Lynch, everybody's in her head. Is Ed Asner Mr. Roque? That's what we need to know.
That is a whole crazy other version of this, for sure. Mr. Roque, who seems to also be a mob king or mob, like the head of some mafia organization,
right,
is the one who seems to have put the hit on Rita and then is pursuing her. It's a strange element, I guess, within Diane's mind. I don't know exactly what he is, except that the actor, Michael J. Anderson, has a kind of a very particular look. He's got a smaller head, and he's sitting on this, like a wheelchair. There's something so peculiar about him as he's standing here, I can't help but think that he is like, if the whole idea was for Diane to hire this hitman to kill Rita, he is like that part of her brain that put all of this into action. And like all of this stuff with the mob and with the hitman and everything are all elements in her mind of the pursuit to kill the person that has broken her heart and destroyed her life. And so I kind of saw him as the way that he's always in this little special room of his, he's behind a wall. It's like the brains of the operation is kind of where I interpreted him.
Right. And he has agents that work in the world, agents. And I think, I think what's interesting about it, like this gets to what I struggle with is this gets to a little bit of my frustration about this movie and its origination as a series. Have you watched any of the pilot
of this?
Yeah. The original ABC pilot.
No,
it's floating around. Like you can find clips of it on YouTube and you can find it on other places that happened. If you find it, it's been ripped and it exists in places. It's really interesting because all of these characters, like Mr. Roque, like the Castellani brothers, Dan Hedaya and Angelo Badalamenti, like these guys who are in the movie for like a scene, purportedly had parts to play over the course of an arc, right? Robert Forster and Brett Briscoe, where the hell do they go, right? Yeah. Like these are like this is the movie makes it come off like stunt casting. But really, these were guys who were in the series and would have had a role in making life miserable for the two principal women who were trying to solve this murder. And when you watch the pilot ends, Andy, at the halfway point of the movie. Right. That's it. And there's a bunch of stuff at the beginning of the movie that's all shoehorned in from the end. There is no sense that there was a flashback mechanism at all in the series. And the way it was pitched, the producer at ABC who remembers it, who was there, said, you know, what happens next after the pitch? And Lynch says, you got to buy the pitch in order to find out what happens next. Like, I'm not even telling you guys who are going to pay for it what happens next until you sign on the line, which is dotted. I mean, power move, but as it turns out, when they watched the pilot, the guy who watched it apparently watched it at 6:30 in the morning with a cup of coffee and hated it, hated every bit of it and canceled it outright. So it never made it and ended up getting cut up and munged around with things that were reshot and things that were added to make the movie that we have. And I did not know that that was the problem I had with the movie the first time I saw it until I watched it this time and then went and learned this. It all made sense to me that the movie feels like we're introducing this cornucopia of characters who don't ever quite get the payoff that they deserved. And it makes the movie messy. Do I like the dream aspect of it? Do I think the entire idea of this character, principal character, processing her trauma by way of this dream sequence is awesome. I love that now, but I can't help but think this movie is messier as a result of its transformation, the way it was made into a movie from the pilot. And it's hard for me to see it any other way at this point.
Well, and I haven't seen that, so I can't speak to that, but I can speak to David Lynch and his struggles with TV shows in general. It certainly was an issue that he dealt with Twin Peaks because, and gosh, you're going to have to correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Twin Peaks initially screened as like a 2-hour TV pilot? But they weren't sure if it was going to get picked up or anything, and so it kind of went all the way through the ending of like there, it had a resolution. And then because it was picked up, they ended up changing the story and kind of modifying it into the actual TV show. And I can't remember if it ended up resolving the same way or not, but that was like, that's what my memory says of the show.
I think that's right. But my memory's as exactly shaky as yours is. You may have just incepted me.
Yeah, right. So it's definitely one of those things that I think Lynch has dealt with in the world of crafting these stories and making them into things that are different. I enjoy this world quite a bit. I would love to see what a TV show version of it is. But that being said, I really like the movie a lot. I enjoy a ton what Lynch crafted here. And so I'm glad that this is what we have. I don't feel like, I don't feel like I need more. I think that I've got what I want out of this.
Well, So now I'm asking a leading question, and I really shouldn't, because I know the answer to it. It's a dream now. I have to accept the fact that all of these sequences of our clumsy murderer, right? The guy who murderer goes to and accidentally shoots a woman through the wall, and shoots the cleaning guy, like all of those things. That's just straight up physical comedy from David Lynch. And once you accept the fact that, at least in my interpretation, all of that is Diane's dreamscape, it all has to make its own internal sense. It has to. But when you come at it from the pilot, when purportedly there's no dream flashback, right? It's just practical. It's hard not to look at these characters and think about what's missing from character threads that start and are unfinished. And that's the cognitive dissonance between these two properties. So accepting the movie as it is what it is, it's processing a dream and it's awesome. Accepting the alternate reality of the fact that I low-key want a Mulholland Drive TV show with David Lynch and Mark Frost at the head of it, that's going to be my fantasy pick.
I mean, I definitely see your point and what you're saying there. And if we were to take that dream ending away that was added to the film, I mean, who knows? Maybe in the TV show, it all would have been a dream as well. It's
maybe.
We really don't know. But I do like the idea of this story, that this is this crazy world in Hollywood, and we're just following a very strange group of characters on this journey, and it could have made for a really interesting show. I definitely agree. I see that.
And this, you just said it. You just said why my heart longs for that show, because if this is a dream, then none of it is real. And the experience outside of the dream isn't all that David Lynchian. Right? I like being in a universe where David Lynch gets to play, and I have to imagine that that is real, that that is the fabric of reality, that there are crazy, crazy people living and doing these kinds of things that aren't in a dream, because a dream excuses behavior. I like the idea of living in the David Lynch movies where behavior is not excused because it just exists.
Yeah. A very strange example that I think speaks to how would it have played in the TV show, or was it a part of the pilot? I don't know. Was it an element that was intended to be just a very peculiar story? But it's the guy in the cafe telling his friend about this dream that he had, about how they go behind the cafe and there's this thing back there, and they that do it, and then he goes back there and this creepy black demon creature dream character, I'm not sure, like the psyche, I'm not exactly sure what it is, pops out from behind the wall and the guy collapses and dies. Like, that is one of those elements that, like, how would that play in a TV show as reality, or would that, does it just seem too much of a dream? And that's I think the interesting element to what Lynch is crafting here.
Well, I'll tell you, the Bonnie Ahrens is the bum. That's who is credited as the demon creature. That's Bonnie Ahrens. And the way the pilot ends is you have that slow reveal across the mirror, that sort of tracking shot as they reveal in the mirror that Rita is now wearing the blonde wig. And Betty says, "You look like somebody completely different." And then it fades to the brick or the cinder block, like dumpster wall, that exact same shot as you come around the dumpster wall. But instead of the bum coming out, like jump scaring you, right? It kind of fades around the corner and we have a slow, like zoom in on the bum sitting on a piece of trash. And so the bum is in the pilot for sure, but it is not a central sort of demon character.
Well, and that scene continues in the film because the bum has like a paper bag, and in it is the blue box. And that's kind of like the bearer of Diane's soul. I'm not exactly sure, but that's the box, like in that bag, we have the blue box in which, you know, she's kind of disappeared into. Those two little people, again, they come running out. And again, I feel like those are part of her, kind of her psyche, kind of like the past parts of herself that are coming back out. And it's a trippy, strange, creepy character. And it's certainly like when in the beginning, when it pops out, it's kind of terrifying. It's like, what the heck just came out here? And
Dan scares himself to death with the thing. That's all we get of Dan. Dan tells a story and then scares himself to death and dies.
And we do see Dan again, though, right? Isn't he in the cafe when, like in the background or something, when she's hiring the guy?
Yeah, the flashback or essentially the reality back, right? of what really purportedly happened. And that's how he had the dream. And that's why he was describing it, because he was that vision of her remembering that experience in the actual thing, in the actual Winkies.
Yeah.
Because again, Jung, he was her.
Just a wild, wild, crazy film.
Yeah, it's bonkers.
Mm-hmm. When the original DVD came out, again, David Lynch doesn't like revealing things, but he did have a list. There was an insert in the DVD that said, David Lynch's 10 clues to unlocking this thriller. These are the clues. Number one, pay particular attention in the beginning of the film. At least two clues are revealed before the credits.
Okay.
What did we decide there? The pillow, like this is her dream. This is something going on in her head. And what would you say the other one is?
I don't know. Was it? It wasn't the jitterbug?
Or the old people?
I don't understand how the old people could be a clue.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so I failed one of those.
Yep. Number two, notice appearances of the red lampshade.
What?
We see the red lampshade. It's next to a phone that rings several times in the film. The first time, it's on the chain of phone calls that happens when the mob team is like following kind of reporting. It's the slow journey of phone calls getting back to the main guy, Mr. Roke. I can't remember. I have to watch it again. Now I can't remember who picks up the phone. I don't think we actually see anybody pick it up or we don't see who it is, but somebody picks it up and it's part of the mystery as far as like telling Mr. Roke that she's gone. Like she got away.
Okay.
And so and then later we see that that's the red lampshade that's next to, as memory serves, Diane's bed. And it's ringing at some point, but no one answers it, right? Because is that because she's dead there? No, I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure that's the same red lampshade and same phone.
I did not pay attention to the red lampshade.
Okay. I wish that I'd seen this list before I watched it.
That would have been handy.
Number three, can you hear the title of the film that Adam Kesher is auditioning actresses for? Is it mentioned again?
Yeah. What was it, though?
I don't remember. He's auditioning for the Sylvia North story.
Right, because the Sylvia North story is the same movie that we get in the flashback when she's the ingenue and Camilla Rhodes is in the car and Adam is kissing her saying... That's the movie. And it's the same director from the audition sequence that she rocked earlier on.
Not in the audition sequence.
That wasn't for the Sylvia. But the director, Bob Booker or whatever, he was the actual director.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of that thing.
Of that thing.
In the reality, quote, reality, the Sylvia North story is the film that Camilla is actually in that Kirsch's directing. That's all just what you just said.
Yes.
So that's... number three. Number four, an accident is a terrible event. Notice the location of the accident. I'm not sure outside of Mulholland Drive.
On Mulholland Drive. But there was another street sign. Was it Mulholland and Sunset?
Well, she walks down the hill and ends up on Sunset.
Okay.
Oh, you know what? Okay. Here's something. It is kind of jungle-ish, or it's kind of that the Hollywood Hills trees, overgrowth, and it's actually the same place. Well, I guess that makes sense. Later, when they stop, it's where Diane meets. We have Camilla come out of the trees and says there's a secret path, and that leads up to Kesher's Hollywood house where he's having the party.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess
that I feel like that I got. I didn't know that was a clue, but that's, I understood that.
Maybe it's just like in the real world, the reason that she's picturing that in her head is because was
not to get shot. But he says the same thing. Like, where she says, we don't stop here. Like, right? Like that.
Right,
okay,
right.
Same thing.
Who gives a key and why?
Okay, so the real key, the blue actual key, was the key to indicate that the assassination had been done, right?
Yeah.
So that was, I don't know what his name was, Chad the assassin?
He leaves it for her, or says, when it's done, I will leave this for you, and it'll show up.
Wasn't it the bum that had the box or the key?
Well, the bum has the key, the box.
Bum has the box. Who had the key originally? Wasn't it in her purse?
It was in her purse with all the cash.
Yeah.
And we don't know it's for the box until the box mysteriously shows up in Betty's purse.
Yes. All right. So we got that.
But why does he give it? Because he's killed her. And that's why, like, when she sees that, when her neighbor comes over and is getting things and gets the ashtray, and that's when she sees the key, and that's when she's having those last little moments of imagining time with Camilla before she goes and kills herself. Okay. Notice the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cup. Okay. The ashtray, I think we've got the robe.
So the robe is the robe that Aunt Ruth's robe that was on the bed when Betty got there, and it was the big, thick, red, like, velvety robe. And Rita puts it on after her shower. Well, Betty covers her with it when she goes to sleep, you know, just after her concussion. And then she ends up wearing it a couple of times throughout their relationship.
I'm trying to remember, is the robe play into the later story? Is Diane wearing it?
I don't remember Diane in it. Diane was just in a t-shirt, a tank top, like, and that gray, like, nightgown.
Yeah, I just can't remember that. What about the coffee cup? I don't remember that well enough. I'm wondering if, like, a coffee cup that she gives in her house is, like, the same coffee cup that is in the crazy scene with Kesher when Angela Benavente
spits all the coffee out.
Spits the espresso out. Was that the same coffee cup?
Maybe the same coffee cup.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. That was really funny also.
What is felt, realized, and gathered at the Club Silencio?
The Club Silencio. Okay.
Where everything is recorded and nothing is real.
Even though we are hearing the band that doesn't exist, right? Like, I'm not crazy.
Well, I mean, even the guy comes out playing the trumpet, but he's not. Like, he proves that he's not. And the lady who's singing, she collapses and the song's still going.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So what is felt? Well, certainly there's a lot of heartbreak going on there. I feel like, you know, we have Rita in tears as she's watching the performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like that, the breakup, kind of, there's a moment there because that is before they go home to get the money and then they both disappear. Like, so that's right before that.
Is that the sequence where at one point Betty starts shaking uncontrollably?
Yes.
Like everybody starts vibrating?
Yeah. Well, she does. Yeah.
She does.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's
almost like a seizure. Yeah.
Yeah. She seizes. Right. Okay.
Yeah. I feel like it's her subconscious realizing what had happened, that Betty is, or that Rita is dead, and she is responsible, and she's kind of coming to terms with what, like, the decisions she's made.
Okay.
What is realized, what is gathered at the Club Silencio? I don't know. Did talent alone help Camilla?
No.
We have Melissa George plays her in The Dream. She gets the job. She does her performance. And, you know, Kesher is very kind of matter-of-factly tells the guy with him. He's like, she's got the part. And then we see Melissa George later in reality when she goes to that dinner party.
And she's the new arm candy.
For Camilla, it seems.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know if talent alone helped Camilla or if it was that. Really seemed like a Hollywood story, like, you know.
It really seemed like there was this, that he was going to say, this is the girl anyway. And it turned out Camilla was pretty good. right? Like, that was the surprise of that sequence, because we just had somebody who was singing that song and was very talented at it. And then Camilla comes in and is actually really good. Like, she might have gotten the part on her own.
Right. Note the occurrences surrounding the man behind Winkies. I like that they call it the man behind Winkies. Yeah. Well, it's at that scene when he pops out and the guy dies. And then really not until the end when we come around and see him holding with the bag and everything. Mm-hmm. And then there's flashes of that character toward the end of the face and stuff that just seems very... it just felt like the real... like the soul or the psyche or something, like the main part of her that's like hiding back there.
Yeah.
Last question. Where is Aunt Ruth?
Yes, that's actually a great question, because we have Aunt Ruth goes to somewhere.
She goes away.
She goes away. Yeah. But we see Aunt Ruth at the end.
Well,
Aunt Ruth is like going through doors or something.
So she leaves town, and then toward the end, when they both disappear into the box, even the box disappears and she comes into the room. It's almost as if she had heard something. And my impression of that is that we have just entered reality and this is actually her place. She's not actually gone anywhere. And she comes in like, what did I just hear? And it's just her world. But I don't know if she's really Aunt Ruth or if this is just somebody that Diane had run into at some point and just kind of in her little mind movie had kind of cast her as her aunt.
Yeah, that's interesting. But yeah, Aunt Ruth, we never find out, I don't think, where Aunt Ruth goes.
Yeah, I'm just looking online to see if anyone has come up with any theories about Aunt Ruth. Some people say because there's a black hat in that hat box that perhaps she might actually just be dead. Doesn't she say actually?
Oh God, you're totally right. She's at the dinner pool party. Aunt Ruth is dead and left her an inheritance, right? Left. And that's how she's able to start her dreams in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Ugh. Okay.
Man. Again, where is Aunt Ruth? It's a rhetorical question. We're not supposed to name a location, but to consider her entire existence. Whether or not you believe she really existed, certain things are undeniable. She's linked to both Betty and Diane. She seems to be more of a generic term for many ladies we see packing and leaving. The closest we come to a realistic parent figure in the movie.
Interesting.
Trippy, trippy, trippy. I love it.
It's a fascinating watch. It really is. Like, I did not hate this movie.
What do you think of our two leads, Naomi Watts and Laura Elena Herring?
Oh, I think they're fantastic. I think Naomi Watts is perfect, perfect for this role. I mean, just she nails the ingenue part. She nails the Nancy Drew investigator part. And then when she falls apart, she nails the sort of drug-addled, crushed, dreamed Hollywood starlet part. Like, I think she just swings all over the place, and I never get lost in her performance.
What I enjoyed a certain part of her performance is that I think she plays the actress so well, and she's rehearsing that crappy script with Rita and isn't doing that great. I mean, she's doing fine, but both of them are just kind of like, they're just performing it. It feels very performative. But when she goes to the audition and she's confronted with this this actor who is, you know, you can tell that he's just, to kind of keep these things interesting, he's just like, I'm going to do this nice and close just so he can pull her in close and everything. It's just so creepy. But the way that she ends up taking on that performance and like really kind of leaning into everything that he's pushing to do makes for such an exciting audition that actually it worked exceptionally well. And that's kind of what got her noticed by that casting agent, who then walks her across the street to theoretically go meet
Adam.
Yeah. And perhaps audition for that. It's just a really interesting way that those two performances of that scene played out.
Yeah. I thought that was really great. As for, do you know, where did Laura come from? Laura Herring. Do you know much of the Laura Herring catalog?
I don't. I know she's one of those people that I've seen in other films or shows since then. Mostly, I think that I remember her from her run on The Shield. She had like a half season run on that show, which is one of my favorites. And I enjoyed her on that show. I just, you know, enjoyed that show, period. I think largely, I don't think of her as somebody who's ended up getting as many large or interesting roles as she could have, you know. It's that's the thing that's always frustrating. Like, I know she was the wife in The Punisher, like that's, yep. But I don't, and she pops up briefly in just in Inland Empire again, another Lynch film, but I don't think of her as somebody who's kind of had as big a career.
Yeah, I don't either. And she was one of the faces to me. Watching this again, I was like, oh, I know her. No idea where from.
Yeah,
I didn't catch it, but I thought she was really great. And you know, it is kind of a complicated role, especially. I think back to this and wonder, like, how much of this stuff pulled from the pilot did she know that she wasn't a part of the fabric of reality, right? Like, does that change how you play this? If you don't know from David whether you're real or not, whether you're an interpretation. And I think that's a really interesting thing as an actor. Like, how do you present in this movie? I thought that part was really interesting.
Well, just it makes for such interesting stories when actors like have to come up with their own, you know, backdrops that may or may not actually relate to the story. I think that's interesting.
For sure.
I want to jump back to Naomi Watts real quick, just because I think that it's just important to note how important this was for her career. Because before this, like, she had was friends with Kidman back in Nicole Kidman back in Australia. They'd come out to LA, and she was really struggling, like, all through the 90s, was just tiny bit parts, hardly anything, practically broke, just was not able to make ends meet, and ended up getting cast in this. David Lynch hadn't seen any of her work, but just based on her headshot, offered her the lead role. And he said, I saw someone that I felt had a tremendous talent, and I saw someone who had a beautiful soul and intelligence, possibilities for a lot of different roles. So it was a beautiful, full package. And this, again, of course, was for the TV pilot and the show. But of course, you know, she ended up working well in the film. And that really kind of is the thing that gave her her career, like a much more A-list star. And, you know, she's gone on to do so many great things. But it's amazing how for some people they can struggle for so long, and then just one little opportunity, one little breakout thing can give them everything they need to kind of get their career going.
Well, and she's one of those that I think deserves it. It's hard to see a Naomi Watts performance and not appreciate what she's doing. I think she's really, really great.
Did you ever see the remake of Goodnight Mommy? We talked about that last season in our horror debuts, the original version.
No, I never did. Did you?
I didn't either. So much of me says why when the original is worked so well, but I'm curious to know if they've changed anything, you know?
Yeah, me too.
Justin Theroux plays Adam. He is our film director in both worlds. He is an interesting character here. I was reminded, Tommy just kind of hosted a conversation most recently on Sitting in the Dark, one of the other shows that we do over here, and featured an audio clip of Adam talking with the cowboy. And I, when that scene came up, I'm like, where did I just hear this? I just heard this. What was that? And then it came to me. I'm like, oh yeah, it was on Sitting in the Dark when Tommy was playing it. And it kind of for the scope of, what was the name of that series, that particular thing? It was about worlds where you just don't,
they never explain what's going, like, it was all about sort of miscommunication. You don't get to know why the malevolent force is doing the malevolent thing to you.
Yeah.
And right. This was an example of like this is the seedy, like, what is going on in Hollywood that there is a cabal that is like taking action on your behalf. And they say over and over, this isn't your film anymore. Now you just have to do this thing.
Yeah.
The thing that I thought was so interesting to hear Theroux talk about his performance, he says, he apparently asked Lynch, so, you know, what's the deal with, if you see me once, see me twice? Like, are we going to see him once, see him twice? What's going to happen? And Lynch said, I don't know. I guess we'll find out together. And that is the Lynchiest of Lynch answers to that question. That's
and we do see him again at the party at Adam's house. So I don't. It, obviously, that's a different reality. But is that the other time that we actually get it? Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's the once.
Yeah. Crazy little thing.
It's crazy.
Yeah. But, you know, Justin Theroux is a I think mainly my brain, when I think of Justin Theroux, I think of him in Wanderlust because he is heading up that weird little hippie commune that Paul Rudd and Jennifer Aniston go hang out at. And like, and he ends up hooking up with Jennifer Aniston in the film and in real life. And that became like, for me, when I think of Justin Theroux, I think of him as the Wanderlust hippie.
That's funny.
Yeah.
He's Bryce in American Psycho. I don't think we probably didn't talk enough about him in American Psycho.
Probably not enough. Yeah. And he was in I Shot Andy Warhol.
Yeah. Right. Right, right. Man, guy's been around a long time to look like he's about 15. He's just one of those guys. He's a good-looking man, Theroux. Good-looking man. He ages well.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel he's in Beetlejuice coming up. I don't think of him often, like, in things. Like, he's not somebody I seek out to watch the stuff that he does. But when he's in something, I generally am enjoying myself. Like, I think that he plays it well.
Yeah, right. I mean, I have on my queue. I've watched one episode of The Mosquito Coast, and he's great. He's great. But what an awesome property to have him kind of at the head of the family. You know, it looks really, really interesting, and I'm excited to get back into it. I have not seen The White House Plumbers yet, but he plays G. Gordon Liddy in White House Plumbers. That's on the list too.
Nice, nice, nice. So,
yeah, really interesting actor.
Yeah. Other cast that stands out for you? Anyone else in particular you want to talk about?
There's nobody else who stands out because they're all in it for such a short amount of time. Dan Hedaya, love Dan Hedaya. Ann Miller, Coco, awesome.
This was Ann Miller's last film. She was somebody who had been in Hollywood way back when, all the way in things like You Can't Take It With You, Frank Capra's film. So it was great seeing her pop up in this. Same thing with Lee Grant, who plays the casting agent, I believe. Is that who she's playing? Louise. And Chad Everett, who is the leathery guy that Betty reads opposite. So creepy, but definitely a face from a lot of 60s and 70s TV.
And of course, Angelo Badalamenti, we talked about it just a minute ago, that he actually has a role, a very quiet role.
Yeah.
But it was fun to see him in the conference room with the, you know, all the agents and
I really enjoy that the worlds that Lynch creates of kind of like all of the executives and the suits, and they just there's this weight of discomfort that you get with all of them, and he plays that well, and the spitting out of the espresso is just fantastic. So
well, yeah, and segue to the music. Obviously, he does the music, and he's notorious for some incredibly creepy, wonderful scores for David Lynch.
And this fits right in there. Like, it worked well. It's very creepy. It has some haunting themes. It plays really well.
Yeah. Easy. It is another weird, easy listen. It's a mood listen. Like, I sometimes put on the Lynch scores when I'm writing. Like, it's fun to get into the space.
Yeah. No, totally. Monty Montgomery is the cowboy. James Caron is the producer producing the film that Betty comes and auditions for. Rebecca Del Rio is the singer playing herself. I already mentioned Melissa George. And Billy Ray Cyrus plays the pool man that Adam's wife is sleeping with. So a lot of faces, and a lot of these people have appeared in other Lynch films. Lynch is one of those directors who certainly builds a stable of the types of faces and people that he likes to cast in his films.
Yeah.
This film, won cinematography at the Independent Spirit Awards. That's why we're here. Peter Deming shot it. What do you think of the look of the film?
It's a Lynchian look to me. Like, it fits the vibe, I think, that he's going for. Moody, colored, a little bit desaturated, but a lot of red. It's just mysterious and dark, and I think working in partnership with some bonkers production design, capturing Mr. Roque in that big isolated room with the single spot kind of illuminating not the right part of the room. Like, it's a it is a moody vibe, and I truck with it.
There's a lot of play with colors and mood. You're right. It definitely has this very hallucinatory look. There are, at night, a lot of not quite star filters, but some sort of filter put over the lens that gives all the lights a little bit of a kind of a mushy kind of look to the way that they look, that I think is really nice. Sometimes images seem slightly not soft as in focus, but as if they're playing it with some sort of a filter in addition. Like there's a lot of stuff that they're doing to kind of craft a world that feels very dreamlike, which makes perfect sense for it.
Yeah.
And just very creative, very a lot of shots that carry some interesting perspectives and everything. Peter Deming, I'm trying to think, a lot of work with Sam Raimi on things like, you know, we talked about over on the film board, Oz the Great and Powerful. Did we talk about Now You See Me Too or just the first one? Can't remember, but both of those? He shot both those, he was cameraman or DP for those, and Capone, which was also one of the film board films.
Which also looks great.
Yeah.
Right? Peter Deming looked great. Terrible movie. Did look great. We did talk about Now You See Me Too, by the way.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Worked with Lynch. I think Lost Highway was the only other film that he did with Lynch. Lots of stuff with Sam Raimi, though. A lot of the Scream movies with Wes Craven and stuff like Austin Powers. So yeah, all over the map as far as the types of films that that he was shooting. But, you know, I like the look here. And, you know, in the scope of, did it deserve to win of the nominees? I guess we'll talk about that in our awards section coming up shortly or right now.
It could be right. It could be right now.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess if that's everything, we'll be right back. But first, our credits.
The Next Reel is a production of True Story FM, engineering by Andy Nelson, music by River Loom, Oriel Novella, and Eli Ketlin. Andy usually finds all the stats for the awards and numbers at v-numbers.com, boxofficemojo.com, imdb.com, and wikipedia.org. Find the show at truestory.fm, and if your podcast app allows ratings and reviews, please consider doing that for our show. Andy, can you believe we've almost hit 700 episodes of The Next Reel?
I know, it's crazy. And with all the other episodes in our family of podcasts, we are well over 1,200 episodes of movie conversation. It's really pretty amazing that we've gotten to have these in-depth movie chats every week for over a decade now.
And we couldn't have done it without our loyal community of film fans. Their support over the years has meant so much.
For sure. That reminds me, we should give the merch store a shout-out. Buying shirts from thenextreel.com/merch is a great way listeners can continue to support the show. Plus, they get to sport our great designs.
Absolutely. I think sometimes folks forget we have a variety of shirts, mugs, phone cases, and more available. In fact, a great place to start is with a shirt sporting the Next Reel's logo.
We also have that classic Fast Times Spicoli Surf School tee, or the weirdly popular Rusty's European Tour shirt.
The one from National Lampoon's European Vacation. Why is that so popular?
Search me, but we have sold a ridiculous number of those. I guess there are a lot of Rusty's taking trips to Europe?
We're always adding new designs based on movies we've covered, like our brand new design for A Streetcar Named Desire, featuring a streetcar named Desire. So if you want to rep your love of TNR and films, head to thenextreel.com/merch.
Every purchase helps us continue to have these weekly in-depth conversations. So visit thenextreel.com/merch today.
And as always, thanks for listening and being a part of the Next Reel community. We've got lots more great movie chats coming your way. All right. So how did it do at award season?
It was very popular at award season. 50 wins with 61 other nominations. At the Oscars, David Lynch was nominated for Best Director. It was quite a lineup, but all of them lost to Ron Howard for A Beautiful Mind. This is one of those years that, you know, people who get angry at the Oscars don't like the Oscars. This is one of those reasons that people get uppity about the Oscars. At the Saturn Awards, it was nominated for 4 awards. Best Action Adventure Thriller Film, but lost to Memento. Naomi Watts was nominated for Best Actress opposite her friend Nicole Kidman, but lost to her in The Others. Best Director, Lynch was nominated, but lost to Peter Jackson for Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. And Best Music, Badalamenti was nominated, but lost to John Williams for AI, Artificial Intelligence. At the Cannes Film Festival, Lynch tied Best Director, winning with Joel Coen for The Man Who Wasn't There. And the film was nominated for the Palme d'Or, but lost to The Sun's Room. As for cinematography, there were 4 other cinematography nominations, no other wins, except for the reason we're here, the Film Independent Spirit Awards. This won the category Best Cinematography. So of the nominees, we've got this, we've got The American Astronaut, we've got The Deep End, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and Memento.
Oh, wow. This is it.
How does it stack up? This is the winner.
I have a hard time. You know, I really enjoyed Hedwig, but I think even when I compare this to the other films in the category, I come back to The American Astronaut as doing some of the most interesting things on camera in black and white. And, you know, there's a distinct Lynchian vibe to The American Astronaut. I mean, clearly it's a it takes some of its taste as homage to what Lynch is doing. I found myself noting specific shots at how kind of stunningly clever they were, given what they were doing with that movie and the budget that they had to work with. And in this one, I liked Peter Deming's work, but I found myself noting specific shots for kind of how boring they were, right? Like The American Astronaut made shots like looking through handles on beer steins interesting and crazy compelling. And Deming and Lynch made a piano ashtray look exactly like a piano ashtray, right? Like they had opportunities to send signals with camera that I think they chose the simpler route. And I think The American Astronaut was trying to do so much more and succeeded.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with your interpretations of some of the reasonings in this particular film. I really think that all the cinematography worked quite well in this film. But that being said, I think that your point about The American Astronaut is a solid one, regardless of any differences of opinions with Mulholland Drive. And of the two, I think that I would probably put The American Astronaut up top as well. I just think that there's such an interesting exploration with the camera through the entire film.
I will also watch The American Astronaut first again, right? Like, that's a movie I will put on again. And I probably will Mulholland Drive too, but that one I'll put on first.
Of the other films, like, for me, it probably would be The American Astronaut as my pick, and then Mulholland Drive, and then I guess Memento next. You know, I wonder if that one just got the nomination because of the split in color versus black and white to tell different parts of the story and how it was used. And then Hedwig and then The Deep End. That would probably be my order if I thought about it.
I think I can agree with that. I may switch Mulholland and Memento, but I think I have a stronger opinion of the visuals on that one than you do, maybe. But I think largely we agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, for a David Lynch movie, it's weird, but did he make any money?
Well, Lynch's movie cost $15 million to make, and I'm assuming that was like from, they kind of took the TV pilot budget and then added to it to do this. So I'm assuming that's the total, or $26.8 million in today's dollars. Unlike the rest of the movies in this series, it did not play at Sundance, instead taking the highbrow direction of opening at Cannes instead, where Lynch has often been loved. This then opened limited October 8th, 2001, opposite Training Day, Serendipity, Joyride, and Max Keeble's Big Movie. It expanded up to 247 screens, but it never found a large audience. It did, however, go on to earn $117.7 million domestically and $235.2 million internationally, for a total gross of $797.6 million in today's dollars. That lands the film with an adjusted profit per finish minute of $81,500, another success for Lynch.
But Max Keeble's Big Movie, Andy. Big move. Big move.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, I'm glad we talked about it. I'm glad, I'm relieved that I did not hate it.
I am too. It would have been sad had
that
you hated
this one.
That would
have been so sad, right?
Yes, absolutely. Oh,
man.
All right, well, yeah, I'm glad we talked about it, but we're going to be moving on now to our next series. So we'll be right back for our ratings, but first, here's the trailer for next week's movie, kicking off the next series, where we're going to be looking at, this should be fun, the 2013 Fangoria Chainsaw Awards for Best Actor. We'll be looking at the five nominees, kicking off the series with The Gray, Joe Carnahan's film, and then we'll do Kill List, Sinister, the Spanish film, Sleep Tight, and ending with The Woman in Black.
A job at the end of the world. There's not a second goes by when I'm not thinking of you.
Going home, guys.
Help the one off!
You'll find us.
Nobody's gonna find us. Not here. We figure out one way of south and we start walking.
This will be one of those wild stories you tell at a party.
Listen. Don't move. Stare right back at him. If we can get to that tree line, we can better defend ourselves.
Go! Go!
You gotta be kidding me.
We could climb down.
Grab him! Ah!
I want to see your face, feel your hands in mine.
The Gray, rated R, starts January 27th.
It is hard to believe we've been having in-depth weekly conversations about movies since 2011.
You're telling me producing this show week after week is so much fun, but it does require a lot of work behind the scenes. If you'd like to help support our efforts, one easy way is by using our Originals page when shopping for books and movies that we've covered.
Your purchases made through our links give us a small commission at no extra cost to you and allow us to keep having these great discussions.
The Originals page at thenextreel.com/originals links to the source material for all of our adapted film discussions. Purchasing through our links supports the show.
In season 13, we explore various awards categories and the films nominated in them.
We wrapped up our 1940 Best Picture series with adaptations of Mice and Men from John Steinbeck and Wuthering Heights from Emily Bronte's novel, not to mention the play Dark Victory by George Brewer Jr. and Bertram Block.
The 1947 Academy Award adapted screenplay series featured Anna and the King of Siam, based on Margaret Langdon's book, plus The Best Years of Our Lives, Brief Encounter, and The Killers.
The 1952 cinematography nominees included Death of a Salesman and A Streetcar Named Desire, A Place in the Sun, based on both a play and a book, and Strangers on a Train, based on Patricia Highsmith's first novel.
So many great movies based on books and plays, like Beckett, The Pumpkin Eater,
A Boy and His Dog, Rollerball,
The Princess Bride, Congo, The Scarlet Letter,
Jackie Brown, The Deep End, The Gray, The Woman in Black,
and Top Gun Maverick, which I'm very much looking forward to revisiting.
Get the source books at thenextreel.com/originals.
Start your next read or reread from the movies we've covered. Visit thenextreel.com/originals today. Okay, Andy, Letterboxd.
Where are you going with this one? I want to know where you're going with this one. Do you remember what you did for Wild at Heart?
That feels like a troll. Like, you probably know what I did.
Well, I really don't. I'll look you up.
Hold on. What would I possibly have done for Wild at Heart? I gave it 2 stars.
Oof. Wow. Okay. Did you like this one more or less? It sounds like you liked it more.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I liked it. The problem is I liked it. What I would have said before, I liked it much more than Wild at Heart.
Mm. Okay.
Now I'm not sure much is appropriate. This was kind of a, since I would have given it 1 star when it came out, like I was looking at a 3-star and a heart for this movie this time around. And
okay.
And it could have been a 4-star if it weren't for the weighty baggage of my desire to see this as a series. It's weighty baggage I can't let go of.
This film I was just really taken by, and I feel like it's so close. I'm like, is this on the same level as Wild at Heart? And I like this, I think, at the same level, if not maybe a tiny bit better. So I'm going to go 5 stars and a heart for this one. I really, really enjoy this crazy film.
Well, because Wild at Heart for you was 4.5.
4.5. So yeah, this one I was like 4.5, 5. It was in that same zone. So I'm going to go 5. 5 stars and a heart
well,
from me.
At this rate, this one more watch in this movie might be a 5-star for me. So
it could happen. It could happen. That's,
yeah. Trend lines are fun.
That's right. Remember, you can find me over at Letterboxd at Soda Creek Film. You can find Pete at Pete Wright. You can find the show at The Next Reel. So what did you think about Mulholland Drive? We would love to get your thoughts. Hop into the Show Talk channel over at our Discord community, where we will be talking about the movie this week.
When the movie ends,
our conversation begins.
Letterboxd giveth, Andrew.
As Letterboxd always doeth.
Okay. I think we both went by review activity this time, right?
I did. I know I did.
Well, I did.
Okay.
And well, I think I knew you did. where'd you end up? What's your star rating?
I ended up going 5 stars, very easy, by Ian Fastert, 5 stars in heart. This is La La Land's evil twin.
Yes. Yeah, it is.
Yes, indeed. Love that.
I actually did Maria's 4.5-star. Me, while watching this movie, what is going on? Am I really dumb? Help. Also, the F is my man's Billy Ray Cyrus doing here? Are you lost, sugar? Me, after the movie ended, what kind of Donnie Darko mind F was this? Let's go to my old pal YouTube. They will clear it out for me. Me, after watching 22-minute movie analysis video, this is a masterpiece. David Lynch is an effing genius who coughs. I'm a genius for understanding it immediately, obviously, coughs. What a fun little movie. There's a lot of drama in there.
There is.
A lot of drama from Maria. Thanks, Letterboxd. I've been podcasting since 2006. In that time, I've tried countless hosting platforms. But in August 2022... we switched to Transistor to power all of our shows here at True Story FM, and it's been a game changer.
I love the Transistor allows unlimited podcasts and storage without extra charges. We can publish so much content, and we do. If you want to start up a podcast, do yourself a favor and host your show on Transistor.
With their one-click publishing, you can get your new show onto all the major podcast directories effortlessly.
And their website builder lets you quickly build custom sites for each show.
The detailed analytics are invaluable, too. You can access all kinds of listener data anytime.
Oh, and the versatile players allow you to embed episodes anywhere to reach new listeners. Plus, the team behind Transistor is super responsive and keeps making the platform even better.
After using countless hosting services over 15-plus years, Transistor has been, hands down, the best podcast partner for us.
If you want a hosting platform to take all the worry out of getting your podcast out into the world, go to thenextreel.com/transistor and check it out.
Support our show and support your own show by going to thenextreel.com/transistor. Start growing your podcast today.